Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Welcome to Destination Hockey. Today we have two very exciting interviews in store, but first, here is your live and local forecast. This afternoon we have isolated showers with a high of 83 degrees. Tomorrow it will be sunny and 84 degrees. Friday it will also be sunny with 87 degrees as the high. And Saturday that beautiful weather will continue with a high of 86 degrees. None of that rain and thunderstorms that we've been having this week. It will be beautiful and it will be a true summer weekend. So look forward to that. But before that, we do have two special interviews in store today on Destination Hockey. So we will be right back.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
¿Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de familia a familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Prospects. Like a fine wine, they are not completely understood, take a while to mature, and cause debate amongst their connoisseurs. Thankfully, today we are joined by an expert to break down one of the NHL's most unique facets. Scott Wheeler, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. So you just published your top 50 drafted NHL prospects ranking. How much time goes into a piece like that?
Oh, well, it's a year, two-year, three-year kind of thing. It's a massive project for me. I watch these kids play from the time that they're 16, 17 years old until the end product for something like this. And the end product for a lot of these kids is now that they're 19, 20, 21 years old. That tends to be the range of most of the players who feature on the list. So in some cases, I've been watching the kids for 4 years. Once it comes to finally sitting down and sort of putting together the list, if you will, that process happens fairly quickly. I spent about a week or two kind of stopped writing for all of my other obligations at The Athletic and just dove back into some video, looked over my notes, began thinking about the things that I value in these players, and then ultimately slotted them from 1 to 50. There were a lot of players that didn't make the list. There were roughly 100 players that I at least peripherally considered. So you're looking at a player sort of base of 125, 150 players. So it's a lot. It's my, if not my biggest project of every year, then probably my second biggest project of every year after my draft ranking. And one of those things that I'm really passionate about and I'm really excited when I get to hit publish on. So it's nice to finally kind of have it out there in the world.
What are the main factors that you take into account when ranking these players? Is it all on the ice stuff, or is it just kind of that gut feeling that you have when scouting a player?
It's complicated. I'm different than a lot of evaluators in that a lot of evaluators truly place the most value on the percentage that they put on a player to make it in the NHL. So regardless of where that player ends up in a lineup, the safer players and the players who project more solidly as NHL players tend to rank higher with a lot of people. I don't see it that way. My list skews heavily towards skill and upside and ceiling. So the players that you'll see on my list, there tends to be a little bit more risk involved with the players who rank the highest.
obviously with players like a Jack Hughes or a Capocacco, there's virtually no risk involved. But after that, the players that I value from 3 to 50 are players that I think can project really high in an NHL roster and that have the chance to be not only impact players, but potential star players in the NHL. And guys who are safe bets for a third or fourth line role or a third pairing defenseman, even though they have value as prospects and even though they're legitimate prospects, they tend not to be major considerations for me. So I would just say that skill and speed and puck ability and the ability to finish off plays and get to the net and create on the middle of the ice are the things that I value the most in a prospect, and that's true as much for forwards as it is for defensemen.
Sure, the teams like the St. Louis Blues just won the Cup with a very physical game, but it's tough to deny that the NHL is moving towards a speed and skill game, as you just highlighted upon. Does that affect your rankings where you look more towards a smaller player like Cole Caulfield, Quinn Hughes, and not really show as much concern because they're smaller size or smaller weight?
Well, I don't think I'm per se looking for smaller players, but I think ultimately that some smaller players are better at certain things and that my ranking tends to skew that way regardless. There's this old saying in hockey that I really don't like that says, if all things are equal, you take the bigger player, but all things are never equal. From my standpoint, players are so different that there is never a player who's exactly like another. If there were, then our jobs would be a lot easier than they are. So it's up to me and other people who try to do what I do to sort of find the nuance and find what makes players different, and I think certainly, if you can find a 6'3", 6'4" player with a ton of talent and puck skills and someone who can move and skate like a smaller player and handle the puck in tight to his body like a smaller player and release from various release points like some smaller players have an advantage of doing, then you take that guy 9 times out of 10, I think, of a player like Evgeny Malkin in that way. He's built his career being a guy who can play small despite being big. So, yeah, ultimately it tends to skew smaller. The game is certainly getting smaller. That doesn't mean that there's not value for big players. There are some sort of really big, strong players up and down my ranking, players like Vitaly Kravtsov, players like Dylan Cousins, players like Kirby Dach. So there are a number of players who cracked my list who have that size advantage. But those are also players who have high-end skill sets, and I think ultimately the commonality has to be that they can make plays, and it has to be that they can keep up at the NHL pace, and sometimes that can be more of a challenge, if you will, for taller, heavier players who struggle with foot speed.
Only 22 players from last year's top 50 remain on the list. How does this show the ever-changing talent hierarchy in the NHL?
Well, I think that's a perfect example of how the game is shifting. That shows, A, that, I mean, certainly there were players on last year's list who were still eligible for this year's list who just slipped because they didn't play well, but ultimately it demonstrates the number of players that actually rose out of the list by virtue of their sort of ability to make and stick in the NHL, and that speaks to the fact that increasingly in today's game, 18, 19, and 20-year-old players have proven that if the talent level is there, that they're capable of playing at the NHL level, and not just playing at the NHL level, but being impact players. There used to be a time when players who played deeper in a lineup, and kids in particular, would have to earn it. They would have to earn their way up the lineup. They would start on the fourth line, and then they would have to sort of work their way to the first line. We know now that a lot of these kids don't need that. Elias Pettersson was one of the Vancouver Canucks' best players from day one, and he deserved to play on their first line because of that, regardless of his NHL experience. And I think that's going to be true of a lot of players who are on this list next year when you look back, and there's not going to be a Quinn Hughes on this list next year. There's not going to be a Cale Makar on my list next year because they're going to have graduated and they're going to have become impact players. So it just speaks to the talent level and the way the game is trending towards really rewarding young players and putting young players in spots where they can succeed.
Let's move on to highlighting a few specific teams, many of which were highlighted heavily on your rankings. First up, who else but the Colorado Avalanche? Just how bright is their future?
Yeah, when I think of the 3 or 4 teams in the NHL that are best built for long-term success, the Avalanche are, if not number one on that list, then probably number two. And they have it all. They have cost-controlled players who are already certified stars in guys like Nathan MacKinnon, who's on a really cheap contract for what he provides, and Samuel Girard, who's another cost-controlled young player who's excellent, Mikko Rantanen, et cetera, et cetera. And then they also have this wave of high-end talent coming that is going to allow them on their entry-level deals to be a really competitive team. And guys like Cale Makar and Bowen Byram and Alex Newhook, who I really like and who was also featured in the top 50, those three players are going to be impact guys. And it just gives them so much depth, particularly on the blue line, where they're now going to have three or four core pieces that are in their early 20s. To really just grab hold of what they have going. And I think ultimately the Avalanche are just going to go as far as their goaltending will take them. I think they have as good depth at forward and on defense as any team in the NHL. And ultimately the X factor for them is going to be whether they can find a goaltender who can be the star level starter that most teams that go deep in the playoffs have.
Do you get a little bit of concern, however, at least in the short term, with throwing out a defensive core with three or four really young kids? Does that concern you, or is that a sign of the changing NHL and just the talent they have instilled with these young stars?
It's not a major concern for me. I don't look at age, and I look at the skill set and the talent level. And when I look at a player like Cale Makar, I see a kid who's going to immediately become one of the better defensemen in the NHL. I suspect that he's going to be a front runner for the Calder Trophy. I wouldn't be surprised if he put up 40 or 50 points as a rookie defenseman, which we rarely see. I mean, Rasmus Dahlin did it last year, but it's really rare for that kind of output out of a 20-year-old. And I think Makar's got a chance to do that. I think he's going to drive a number one power play, and ultimately his age won't be a major factor. There might be some warts defensively here or there, but I think players like him and players like Bowen Byram, there's no guarantee Byram makes that team this year. He may head back to junior for one more year before making the jump. But when and if Bowen Byram makes the team, he's going to spend so much time playing on offense that any of the warts that you might see out of a young defenseman in his own zone are going to be mitigated by his ability to just have the puck all the time. And I think Makar fits there. Samuel Girard certainly fits there. Connor Timmins, once he makes it, will be in that category as well. There's just too much talent for them not to figure it out.
One of the best defensemen on that team prior to an early offseason trade was Tyson Barry, and he was traded to the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Colorado Avalanche actually retained half of his contract. It did, in return, bring over a much-needed middle six forward, a center that they were craving. Do you like that decision to trade Barry, or do you think that could come back to haunt them with this young defense core?
I think that was a classic example of a trade that works out for both teams. I think for Colorado specifically, the arrival of players like Makar and like Samuel Girard made that move an option. And there are not a ton of teams in the NHL that are willing to move on from a regular 50-point defenseman and one of the more dynamic offensive defensemen in the NHL, like the Avalanche did with Barry. But it just allowed them to upgrade elsewhere on their roster, and they've always needed someone who can kind of play that second, third-line center role and be an impact guy and help out on the power play, and that was their biggest hole. And it allows them, by adding Nazem Kadri, to slide Tyson Jost down the lineup, and everybody kind of slides on that roster now into a position that is more comfortable for them. And now you look up and down their roster, and there are no real holes. So I think it was a move that they will like. I think Kadri's deal is a favorable contract for them, and he gives them something at center that they lacked in terms of a player who's physical and a player who has a decent finishing touch.
Moving on to another team with a real nice future, that's the New York Islanders. Three of their top prospects made your list, all selected in the 2018 NHL draft. Where do you project Noah Dobson to be within a few years?
I think his upside is as a number two. I don't think he's going to be that kind of true number one defenseman that every team covets. If there are 31 teams in the NHL, it's kind of ironic that there are only probably 15 or 20 defensemen that would be consensus number one defensemen. It's just extremely hard to find that guy who is without flaws and who can play 25, 26, 27 minutes a night and be an impact guy in the power play. And I think Dobson has the chance to be an excellent NHL defenseman, someone who can run a number one power play, someone who can play big minutes, but he's not going to be the kind of Norris contending defenseman that every team wants. So Ultimately, that's where I project him. I love his skating. I love his length. I love his ability to make plays despite being a really tall defender. There are some defenders, once they get up to 6'3", 6'4", can kind of struggle to make the play, the offensive zone plays that you'd hope for out of a truly dynamic defenseman, and I think Dobson has that. So there's just a ton to like about Noah Dobson. I think he's going to be a really impact player for the Islanders, and I think you could imagine him, if not as a number one, then as a very good number two or number three on a contending team.
Adam Boqvist, Evan Bouchard, and Dobson were selected within five picks of each other in that draft. How do you rank those three players up against each other?
Well, I think Bouchard has established himself as the sort of clear front runner of those three players. Bouchard doesn't have the skating ability that the other two kids have, but everything else about Bouchard's offensive game and the way that he manages the puck and how efficient he is as a playmaker has really blown me away over the last couple of years. He's now put together two of the most productive junior-level seasons we've ever seen out of a defenseman at the OHL level, at least offensively. His defensive warts, I think, have often been overstated, and I really think that Bouchard's going to be a star-level player. I think Boqvist and Dobson have the chance to do that, but Boqvist's game is going to be reliant on him being sheltered defensively. Boqvist is going to have to play in a lot of offensive situations. He's going to be an extremely dynamic player in terms of the power play, probably one of the more dynamic players in the power play because he's such a shot threat. Boqvist has one of the better shots outside of the NHL for a defenseman. And then Dobson would probably be a close third, but all three of them are fabulous players. There isn't a massive gap between them, but if I had to rank them, it would probably be Bouchard, Boqvist, and then Dobson third.
Quinn Hughes is another fabulous player. He was selected at pick 7 just before that trio of D-men. Why do you think Quinn Hughes fell so much in that draft? Because looking back on it, it looks like he will be a star.
I think ultimately the two things that resulted in Quinn Hughes falling were A, his size. He's only 5'10", and we don't often see truly transformational sort of organization building block defensemen who are 5'10". And then the second thing was that he kind of lacked a physical element and a shot element that a lot of teams covet in a player who, particularly a defenseman, who they want to take in the top five. He doesn't have the big shot like a player like a Bowen Byron, who was taken in the top five this year, does. So ultimately, I think that's what pushed him down. But everything else about Quinn Hughes' game should have meant that he should have gone third or fourth overall in that draft. I always had him third or fourth overall throughout that draft year. And I think ultimately his skating ability is world class. He's among the best skaters on the planet. His ability to hang on to the puck with that skating is elite. And he's a brilliant playmaker. And I think ultimately the job of a defenseman is to transition from defense to offense. And Quinn Hughes does that as well as anybody outside of the NHL does. So I'm really looking forward to watching him play with the Canucks this year. And I think between him and Makar, those two defensemen in particular, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch the Calder race.
Finally, Oliver Wahlstrom, back to the Islanders, struggled with Boston College last year and now will need to refine his game at the AHL level in Bridgeport. Is that a player who can turn things around and be a legitimate top forward in the NHL?
Yeah, I think he is. Oliver is a kid who I think struggled because he wasn't placed in a role where he was able to play on the first line like he basically has for the entirety of his career. And he was asked to play on kind of a second or third line role with that team in Boston, and ultimately it just didn't really click for him. He didn't get to play in the offensive situations that a player with his talent really thrives in, and I think ultimately that led to his decision to leave college and to turn pro. There's no question it was a disappointing year for him. He should have been better. I expected more of him last year. But I do think that his talent level as a sort of versatile winger who can play as a power forward or play as kind of a wall guy who works from the outside in and can also sort of play as much as a scoring threat as he is a playmaker, that versatility, even if it's not super, super high-end in any one facet, I think that versatility will lend itself to the pro game, and I think ultimately it will probably make him a very good second-line forward at the NHL level. So I just think patience is required with Oliver, and Wahlstrom will figure it out.
Before we let you go, you are beginning The Gifted, a series on hockey's most unique prospects. How exciting for you is putting this unique series together?
It's a ton of fun. It's a real passion project for me. I began it with 10 players 3 years ago now in 2017, so this is the third year of the project. And basically the idea is that I handpick the players who I think have skill sets that they've mastered and skill sets that they've turned into a unique asset for them. So these aren't the best prospects in the world. They aren't the most prolific prospects in the world. They're just prospects who I think do one thing or a combination of things so well that it makes them unique. And a lot of players get sort of typecast in today's NHL game. You get, particularly with prospects, you get compared to players very quickly. The speedy center is always compared to Jeff Carter, and the big power forward is always compared to Milan Lucic in his prime, and the big center who can pass becomes Joe Thornton. And I think oftentimes we put too many expectations on these kids, but there are still kids who kind of fit those archetypes in unique ways. And The Gifted is about really digging down on how a skill set works within a game and how one skill can create a player and how a player can build an entire game around one skill and how they operate off of each other. And it's just been a ton of fun. So I'm really excited to get it going. I launched it today with part one of what will be another 10-part series with Cale Makar, and I'm looking forward to diving into the next 9 players here over the next 2.5 months.
That was a deep dive into the world of prospects with Scott Wheeler of The Athletic. Thank you so much for joining me today.
No sweat, anytime.
Of course. So when we return, Anders Lee's agent, Neil Sheehy, will hold nothing back, letting us know what really happened. And not what really happened, what really, really happened with the Islanders captain's negotiations. From the Destination for All Things Hockey, we will be right back.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Welcome back to Destination Hockey. Today we have a very special guest joining us. Mr. Neil Sheehy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David. I'm happy to be here.
Being an agent is a unique experience that many of us truly don't understand. What exactly goes into your daily routine?
Well, there are many, many things, actually. I think there are a wide range of experiences that it takes to, to be an agent. And, for me, I played the game all my life. I played it in college. I went on and had the NHL career, and so I kind of lived it, but you don't live the actual agent experience, but you at least have some idea of things that are important to you as a player. And so, then you become an agent and you realize now you have to be able to get a client. Once you have a client, you have to know what to do with them. And so there are just many different things that you do. No 2 days are the same. You're always looking at different things. You're out watching players. You're talking to people. You relationships with general managers, with teams, with scouts. It's really a multifaceted job.
How much communication do you have with a player, one that's your client?
Well, a lot depends because the engagement too is not just the agent to the player. It's the player with the agent as well. And I like it. The more a player engages with me, I think the better it is for both of us. Also when you're going through a negotiation, you're talking to a player several times a day. During the season, it really varies. Some guys like more contact than others, but players will also reach out. And what I try to do is make players self-sufficient, but they know they have somebody in their corner that knows what they're going through and what it's like to have a career.
Why was going to Harvard so important in preparing for your life post-hockey, specifically as being an agent?
Well, Harvard is a very diverse student body, and it's obviously a great academic institution. But what it did for me was it just gives you the confidence to know that I can really learn anything I need to learn. And I never really thought I would go back to school after I graduated from Harvard. But after playing 11 years of pro hockey, I started to say, well, what's next for me? And that's when I just decided to go to law school. And, not that I really wanted to go to law school, but I wasn't sure that I could handle it. I think graduating from Harvard gave me the confidence to say, well, I see a lot of guys that are lawyers. I think I can handle it. And so I became a lawyer and stayed in hockey. So when I graduated from law school, I had 14 years experience in the game of hockey, as opposed to being a lawyer getting out of law school without any experience.
And to continue this pattern, also being a player, how did that help you understand the player side of the contract negotiation and being an agent, that process?
Well, my first agent was Brian Burke. And my second agent was Bob Goodnow.
Wow.
And, Brian obviously went to management side. Bob Goodnow ended up leaving for the Players Association. And, they were two great guys and people who influenced me greatly. And when I was thinking of what I would do post-hockey career, those are guys that I looked at, and they both were lawyers, so that's why I decided to go to law school. And actually both guys, Brian went to Harvard Law School and Bob was a Harvard undergrad, and so it kind of, I guess there was a connection there that I was a Harvard undergrad, and so I decided to kind of follow in the same path.
Your playing career that we just spoke of briefly was certainly historic. It was marked with many special moments, a number choice that will go down in infamy, and a lot of other cool things as well. Let's start with 1986. Take us through beating the two-time defending Stanley Cup champion Edmonton Oilers in Game 7.
Well, it was a great game for us. That was the game where Steve Smith scored on his own net.
Yep.
And I say that with a great deal of respect because I almost did the exact same play a little bit later in the game. Luckily, the puck went under Mike Vernon's pads, and I did tie the game up for the Oilers. They obviously had great teams, being the two-time defending Stanley Cup champions, and we had a great team as well, and. We had absolute wars between the two, that particular night, it was only fitting, I guess, that Perry Berezan, I think, got credited for the goal. He dumped the puck in, and that was when Steve Smith went behind the net and he went make a pass out front, hit Grant Fuhr in the back of the legs, and the puck went in, and that was the standing goal for the series. And it just showed, it was a complete team effort from our team beating the phenomenal Edmonton Oilers.
That own goal will forever go down in history, but it truly was a seven-game series with a ton of fighting, a ton of grit going in both sides. And fighting is something that's slowly dissipating in the NHL. You were a fighter in your player career, fighting a lot of legends out there. What are your thoughts on that issue currently as it dissipates from the game?
The game is such a great game with speed and skill. And I think that's what sells, and people love love the speed and skill, and fighting when you have sticks in your hands and things, and guys take liberties on teammates and things like that. Fighting was a way of protecting your top players, but the game has changed so much. The league is calling the hooking and the holding and the use of sticks. So there really isn't as much liberties taken on your top players anymore, and therefore fighting really hasn't been it's been slowly dissipating from the game. And I guess I really don't have an opinion on it. The league is stronger than it's ever been, and I think with the speed and the skill, if you look at even videos of the game today versus the game back in the 70s or 80s, the game is so much faster and the skill is so much greater, and that's what makes the game I think the greatest sport there is.
Many of your clients, whether it's Niskanen, Suter, Anders Lee, all big physical players that do like to drop the gloves every once in a while, is that important to you, or is that just kind of a coincidence as it arose and you're picking your clients throughout your aged career?
Well, the three guys you talked about, Suter, Niskanen, and Lee, I don't know how many times they've actually dropped gloves. Matter of fact, I tell them all to put crazy glue in their gloves. They don't need to have the gloves come off. But between the three of them, I'd be surprised if they've had more than seven or eight fights total.
So, the one that comes to my head is Anders Lee, Tom Wilson, after destroying and hurting the Islanders and all their players. Anders Lee just absolutely wrecks Tom Wilson, and in my recollection, he's the only one who's ever beaten Tom Wilson in a fight in his entire career.
Well, I think that just shows you, Anders Lee's character, that when liberties were taken, on a teammate in a way that, what he didn't think was legal, he responded. And that's, that goes back to the fighting piece. There isn't a lot of that in the game today because things are called so much closer. But that was an example of Anders just being a good team guy. But I wouldn't call Anders a fighter at all. Matter of fact, he'll battle hard during the play. But once the whistle blows, he doesn't do anything. He kind of just stops. And I mean, when I played, that's when I just began. That's when the whistle blew. That's when I got going more. But Anders, he's a great goal scorer and player. And when the whistle blows, he stops and gets ready for the faceoffs.
We'll get to Anders in a little bit, but for one quick question before we get to that, you now help players with injuries, connecting disconnects in the body, as you say. How did you learn this strategy, and why is it so effective?
Well, when I played, I always looked for things that could help me, help jumpstart my body, because the body would take a beating. And there were just little things, little tips that I learned. And then I would see different people doing different things. And I always pondered why different things would help. And over time, I found a kind of a common link between all these different methods. And so I started, as I was working with players, and I saw that a lot of things hadn't changed and a lot of the same things that were happening 30 years ago were still being done, I started to try some of these methods on players. And as I had success with it, but a lot of people thought it was weird because I was a lawyer and not a doctor. That's when I decided to go back to school to get licensed and credentialed. And what I chose was to become a neuromuscular therapist. And so I used a lot of these methods because I used them on my own body because, by playing, all the things that a player goes through and where he needs help. And so I developed some of these methods, and I've had great success in helping players feel better. And when you feel better, you can perform better.
How good of a feeling is it for you personally to help others obtain their peak performance?
Well, as an athlete, that's all you want to be able to do is reach your peak performance. And by finding a method that actually helps players do that, it's very rewarding.
You have said at some point we all need help. Why is it so important for anyone, whether it's your top athlete like the ones you represent, or an everyday citizen, to always strive for the best with their body?
Well, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. We're only given one body, and I think we want to take care of it. And at different times, people abuse their body, and certainly I've abused my body, and it doesn't feel so good. And I can tell you that it feels a lot better when you take good care of it, because we only get it one time around.
Finally, another unique element that made up your playing career was you wore the number zero, something rarely done. Did that evolve from getting assigned that number with the Golden Flames to any special feelings of nostalgia for that number?
Well, there's always evolution in everything, but I never had any affinity to wear the number zero. I was sent down to the Moncton Golden Flames. There was a clause in my contract saying that I would get, if I played one more game, I'd get a one-way contract versus the two-way contract that I was on. And right before my contract turned to a one-way contract, I got sent to the minors. Mm. And then there was a trainer named Brian Pataffy. And Pataff came up to me before the game, and he said, he called me She-Cat. So he goes, She-Cat, he said, I got a jersey for you. I just want to know if you'll wear this. And I said, hey, just give me any number. It doesn't matter. I'll wear anything. He goes, no, here. And he unfolds it, and it's number zero. I just started laughing. And I said, you want me to wear that? He goes, yeah, would you wear it? I go, of course I'll wear it. So then I put the jersey on, and Terry Crisp was the coach, and Terry Crisp came over, and he goes, She-Cat, you're going to wear that number? And I said, yeah. He goes, good, I like you already. And so I played four games and five nights on the road, and the team was in last place at the time, and it was a close division, and we went right to first place by winning four games and five nights on the road. The Calgary Flames lost a couple more games, I think two or three games in that same period, and I was on my way back to Calgary, and I got my one-way contract. And so when I got traded to the Hartford Whalers, there are three numbers that I'd worn prior, but they were all taken. I wore five in Calgary. Ulf Samuelsson had that number. I had 15. Dave Tippett had that number in Hartford. So the only other number I'd worn was zero, so I asked Emil Francis if I could wear zero, and when I showed up to the rink, zero was hanging in my stall. And so then I wore it for the first time in the NHL with the Hartford Whalers.
From 0 to 27, one of your best clients and one of the best people out there is Anders Lee. And boy, did he have an interesting offseason. Did you always have a feeling a deal with the Islanders would get done?
Yeah, I had no doubt that a deal would get done with the Islanders. That was the purpose all the way through. I told Lou Lamoriello that from the beginning, that Anders wanted to be an Islander. He wanted to be there. Even when he became an unrestricted free agent, teams called, and I spoke to them up front. I wasn't going to jerk anybody around. I just told them, he still wanted to be an Islander, and, I didn't want to jerk people around. But, you still get an idea of what the market is, because Anders is a good player, and teams would love to have him. And so I had a pretty good idea what the market was, and I think Lou certainly knew what the market was, and ultimately we came to an agreement.
Was it just a battle over term that took so long, or were there other factors at play?
Yeah, actually it was Lou and I agreed pretty well all the way through. We agreed originally at $7 million, and so it was really a matter of term, and And Anders could sign an 8-year deal if he re-signed with the Islanders. I never really demanded the 8-year. You know, you start asking for 8 years. I said I'd agreed to 7, and really the Islanders were at 6. And so, you know, we just played, you know, we just continued to play, and Anders had the year he had, and then we just said, well, let's see what in 2019, and there were other players that signed, you know, even much larger contracts, and it turned out that we ended up getting the 7 years, and that's pretty well what we wanted from the beginning.
How rewarding is it for you and your client to get that deal that you wanted after so many, you know, negotiation cycles, so many phone calls, fighting over that 1 year?
You know, it's not about me. It's about, you know, it's about the player. And to Anders' credit, he went out and performed.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. When you have a 6-year deal sitting, looking at you, and you're not signed, and there's nothing guaranteed, but you're willing to go out and perform, and Anders had to do that. He didn't put up the numbers that he had the year before, but certainly the team did much better, and he was captain of the team, and everything I think just worked out perfectly. It worked out well for Anders. It worked out well for the Islanders, and now they have a team where they were able to keep all their players, and I think the Islanders can be a destination team.
One of the most unique factors of last season was Lee getting named captain, leading the Islanders on a historic run that no one expected. And a lot of people just didn't see that season coming. How proud were you of Anders Lee just to do what he did? And how did you kind of see that coming, knowing the person and just how hardworking and determined he is?
Well, nothing surprises me with Anders just because, the person that he is. And, it said volumes of, what the Islanders think of Anders, naming him captain. But, these are qualities that I've known that he's had for a long time. He was captain at Notre Dame as well. And he's just one of those guys that he draws people to him because, of the human being that he is. And then to be able to add his skill and ability on top of that and perform at such a high level, nothing surprises me with Anders because he just has a unique way about him that just illustrates leadership all the time.
Artemi Panarin was a huge factor of the offseason, perhaps the biggest storyline to unfold. And the Islanders were pushing hard on Panarin. He eventually went to the Rangers, took a pay cut to go to New York. How did that impact negotiations with Lee, considering Lou Lamoriello was pushing for the star?
It really didn't affect anything. Nothing changed between Lou and I. And a lot of reports were that they went after Panarin, and if they signed Panarin, they wouldn't have had Anders, and that's just completely not true. And we had the basis in place. We didn't have anything finalized, but we had talked about the deal and that the deal wasn't going anywhere.
Had Panarin come to the Islanders and gets that $12.5 million a year deal, does Lee, being the team player he is, potentially take a pay cut to look at the long-term future of the team, or would he stick to that term and average annual value that he wanted?
I guess you never know where things, you get a player of that caliber and, if that would change anything. That's a hard hypothetical to talk about. I don't really think whether they would get Panarin or not get Panarin. I don't think it would change where we were, but I guess I'll leave that to the speculation of the experts.
The Islanders seem to always have been the destination, but other teams were calling and offering big dollars. Did this sway the negotiations and perhaps make some people think that Anders Lee took a pay cut to return to Long Island?
You're only taking a pay cut if you actually accept a deal. So you never accepted a deal, but I guess a better way of putting it, could Anders Lee have made a lot more money if he would have chosen to go to another team? And the answer is yes. He could have made a lot more money somewhere else. And, I mean, we're talking about a lot of money. You know, dealing with these types of numbers, it's staggering. But it's all a lot of money. But, yes, Anders took less money to come to the Islanders.
Well, that's great. Reaffirming the
idea. Let me say, to stay with the Islanders.
Yes, very true. But all we know from this conversation about Lee is just a truly good person, does a lot with the community, and he did want to be an Islander. That's confirmed, and just shows that he truly is a New York Islander, born and bred.
Absolutely. Absolutely true.
And Lou Lamoriello, the man who implemented this whole system and brought the Islanders together, he's a unique character to work with, to say the least, but he also is a Hall of Famer, a perfect general manager in terms of putting teams together that gets them to contend. What's it like to negotiate with him and work with a character like Lou Lamoriello?
Well, the one thing you know, you're going to get honesty. And he's an honest guy. And you know where you stand, and he's not afraid to tell you. And, you know, he has his views. We don't always agree. And you don't have to always agree, and he certainly listens to other points of view, and we can agree to disagree, and then you have to let time determine what course you go, and we both have arguments throughout the season, different things we talk about. At the end of the day, sometimes it comes down to deadlines, and then you have to make decisions. And I think Lou gave some, and we gave some, and at the end of the day, it really came down to that the Islanders wanted Anders, and Anders wanted the Islanders, and that's what ended up being done.
Over the course of the year, just how much time did you spend working with Lou?
Well, we spoke a lot. I think I took 9 trips out to Long Island, and
wow.
The ongoing joke whenever I saw Lou was he asked me if I had an apartment here. but it was fun. I came out, we spoke a lot, and a lot of times there wasn't a lot to talk about, but I came out to see Anders as much as anything, and make sure that he was on track and continuing to do the things he needed to do. It was a fun year to be a part of it and be able to watch the Islanders and see how they turned it around, just so quickly after John Tavares left.
Two interesting contracts that took place during your negotiations were the Jeff Skinner deal and the Kevin Hayes deal, two contracts that many in the hockey world thought was a lot for the player. You have said various times that you were just negotiating that term. You had that average deal done with Lee. Did you and Lou kind of look over your shoulders when those deals went out, and did that affect you in any way?
Well, I think it probably – I certainly looked over my shoulder, and did they affect me? Yeah, they affected me for sure. I don't think they affected Lou. but it was one of those – it's something I have to look at, and really, what it comes down to is, do I think those contracts raise the market? The answer is yes, but the question is, that's if the player's really on the open market, and those are decisions the player has to make. Do you want to go after the most money, or do you want to stay with the Islanders? And that's really what it came down to, because as I said earlier, he could have gone elsewhere and made a lot more money. But my instruction from Anders was that he wanted to get this deal done. And Lou stayed focused on where he was at. And Lou went to 7 years And, you know, after talking with Anders said, "Yes," and that's what I did. I took instruction from Anders, and the deal was done because Lou wanted him and Anders wanted to be there.
The media oftentimes reports things throughout these negotiations that conflict with the actual reality. It happened with Lee. It happened with Robin Leonard. It happens with a lot of players. So finally, to summarize this Anders Lee conversation, how would you like to clarify the narrative of Anders Lee July 1st that differs from all those reports?
Well, what's interesting is just everybody wants to outscoop everybody else, and then people just create nonsense. And I think one of the biggest things in just dealing with Lou Lamoriello is that everyone says there's all the secrecy, and it's like, you know, look, we don't want to trip over ourselves making comments about things that we don't know exist yet. So just take one step at a time. Don't talk about it. And when a deal's done and there's something to report, that's when you talk about it. Because all the other nonsense doesn't matter. And so we stayed quiet the whole time. We didn't talk about it. All that was out there is that Anders had said that he wanted to remain an Islander. And at the end of the day, he's an Islander.
Finally, before we let you go, another client you represent is Minnesota Wild defenseman Ryan Suter. Landing at the wrong airport, decade-long offers, and Zach Parise highlighted that 2012 offseason. How unique were those negotiations for the Wild, Red Wings, you, the players, and all the other teams involved?
Well, it was a unique time, and that was when there was no free agency period prior to July 1. Everything happened starting on July 1, and a final decision of where Ryan and Zach ended up was not actually announced until July 4th. Hence, the league changing the rules along with the Players Association starting a free agency period the Sunday after the draft. So, but it was, it was definitely unique because so many people were, or the kind of the league was just waiting to see where these two free agents ended up. And, I was getting a lot of calls, you know, asking, you know, how's it feel to hold up the NHL? And I wasn't holding up the NHL. I was just trying to do my job when, you know, at free agency, when you have, all of a sudden you have 30 messages on your voicemail, all you can do is you just methodically call each and every person back and kind of and come up with a game plan and talk to my client about, okay, there's plenty of interest, here are some of the numbers, you know, you need to direct me where you want me to, you know, discuss this, you know, where you want to, you might want to go. We got to narrow it down to at least two or three teams as opposed to having, you know, 25 teams. And I still had to be methodical, call people back. I just couldn't do it in a day, and that's why I went to the next day, and then the same thing the next day, and then Ryan and Zach, or Ryan was interested in talking to a couple of teams. So he met with Detroit, as you said, and with Minnesota. And it wasn't until probably the night of the 3rd where the decision was made that he would go with Minnesota Wild.
Well, thank you so much for providing that insight. That was legendary agent, ex-player, and neuromuscular therapist, Mr. Neil Sheehy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
There you have it. Yes, Anders Lee was always destined to be an Islander. They were just waiting on Artemi Panarin. They were just waiting on that 7th year, but Anders Lee was going to be an Islander. Yes, Anders Lee could have gotten more money from other teams. And yes, it is all over. Anders Lee will be in the blue and orange for the next 7 seasons for the near distant future. When we return, we will highlight all the moves from last week, rapid fire style. We've got literally 2 minutes. So from the destination for all things hockey, we will be right back.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Here we go. Let's go through the moves of the last week and as quickly as possible. First, David Clarkson to Toronto for Garrett Sparks on a fourth-round pick. Really like this for Toronto, even though they're taking a bad contract back. They will put that on long-term injured reserve and use it to manipulate their salary cap situation, allowing them to have a better chance of re-signing Mitch Marner, bearing an offer sheet, or a big command. Plus, they get a fourth-round pick. Good trade for Toronto. Good trade for Vegas. They were able to sign Derek Englin to a one-year $700,000 contract. That was bonus-laden. Without getting rid of David Clarkson's contract, that would not have happened. Another big deal signed was Colton Sissons with the Predators on a seven-year $20 million deal. I have no idea why that had to be 7 years. I know David Poile likes those long-term, lower annual average value, but I have a feeling that he didn't really deserve that much money anyway. $2.85 million a year for a depth forward is still a lot. So for 7 years, don't like that deal for Nashville. Michael Neuwirth has been invited to the Toronto Maple Leafs training camp. Another good move for Toronto. They could really use that goaltender to help back up and provide some challenge for Michael Hutchinson. Milan Lucic was traded for James Neal. That's a great deal for Edmonton because Lucic wasn't going to work out. James Neal at least has a chance, if you put him with McDavid, to put up 20 goals. Jacob Trouba is back with the Rangers on a 7-year, $56 million contract. I like this move for the Rangers. I guess it gives them a top defenseman, a good right-handed shot, but that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for not a number one defenseman, probably a number two or three towards the back end of that deal. Finally, Oscar Sundquist has re-signed with the St. Louis Blues on a four-year, $11 million contract. He was crucial for the Blues on their Stanley Cup run, a big physical presence. He was acquired for Ryan Reeves and a first-round pick, ironically. That trade has definitely worked out for St. Louis. Sundquist is back. I love when teams that win the Stanley Cup retain all their players, and that's what the Blues are doing. So, 2 minutes later, we've gone through all the moves of the week, concluding another episode of Destination Hockey. You can catch us on Instagram at Drive4, F-I-V-E, Twitter at Drive45_, and on Facebook on the official Destination Hockey page. Also, do you need tickets to a game, concert, or Broadway show? Well, I have the solution for you. All you have to do is use code Drive45 on SeatGeek, a website for all your ticket needs. Plus, I will personally assure that you will get $20 off. So not only are you using the code to help out Driver 5 and Destination Hockey, you will be getting $20 off. That's all I've got for you today. For more interviews and analysis, we will have you covered for the rest of the summer. But until next time, from the Destination for All Things Hockey, we'll see you next week.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Your Ameriprise Financial Advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News.